Okay, the next part of our meetings are called What's New in My Specialty. This has been long-standing tradition at this conference. These are short talks, short segments of specialists in their fields that will be talking about what's new in their field. So this goes from 7:30 to 9:30. Each talk is a half hour, and we'll be repeating this actually each day of the conference. Each speaker will be finishing 5 minutes early for questions. And what we'd ask you to do for questions is, rather than raise your hand and ask the question from your table, actually, we have mics set up on both sides of the conference room. And so if you could go to those mics and line up to ask the questions, that would be very helpful. So we'll get started with our first speaker. Carolyn Tadros graduated from Albert Einstein College of Medicine and then did her residency in internal medicine at NYU Medical Center. She did a fellowship in gastroenterology at the University of Vermont. She then joined faculty at the University of Utah. And then as of 2010, our community has been very fortunate to have her join us at McKady Hospital. She is fluent in Spanish, and she's board certified in internal medicine and gastroenterology. And she'll be talking today on GI complications of gastric bypass. So let's welcome Carolyn Tadros.
Good morning. Thank you, Mark. So this morning I'll be talking about gastrointestinal complications of gastric bypass surgery. I'd like to say that I have no financial interest or conflict of interest associated with this discussion this morning. So gastric bypass is something that we're all turning to more and more as our population gets larger. Gastric bypass has been revolutionized in the last 10 years. As complications associated with bariatric surgery have decreased and complication rates have dropped significantly with newer techniques. The obesity epidemic and metabolic syndrome is one of the greatest challenges that we face today in medicine. And the morbidity and mortality associated with obesity has transcended every aspect of medicine. In a 2012 US Gallup poll, it was estimated that 26.2% of Americans were obese. And naturally, physicians and patients alike are looking to gastric bypass surgery to help manage a lot of the medical comorbidities. It's therefore imperative that clinicians are able to identify, diagnose, and treat these complications in an expedited fashion, since many of them can be potentially life-threatening if they go unrecognized. So there are two different types of gastric bypass. Procedure are either purely restrictive in nature or they are malabsorptive. And the two purely restrictive procedures that we typically see are lap bands or sleeve gastrectomy. And the concept is that they decrease the volume of the stomach in order to curtail the amount of ingested material. And the lap band achieves this by placing a elastic ring around the top part of the stomach and exerting external compression. It is associated with significant acid reflux just because of the mechanical pressure exerted in the stomach. And a sleeve gastrectomy is where the stomach is actually transected, and all that remains of the stomach is a thin sleeve, and this is very effective in reducing the amount of oral intake. So the focus of my conversation this morning is going to be the Roux-en-Y gastric bypass, and this is by far and away the most common form of bariatric procedures performed in the United States. Approximately 80% of bariatric procedures are Roux-en-Y. And the anatomy is very important to keep in mind, especially when we're managing complications that arise from the procedures. So the surgery starts off by making a small pouch from the existing stomach and separating it. They then divide the small intestine, typically at the level of the jejunum. And the proximal end of the jejunum is then anastomosed to the gastric pouch, creating the gastrojejunal anastomosis. The distal end of the small intestine, which is typically jejunum, is then anastomosed distally. So the flow throughout the gut involves the gastric pouch, goes into the jejunum, and then the gastric acid, bile, and pancreatic enzymes are then imported into the bowel to meet the material further downstream. By bypassing a large segment of small intestine, absorption is severely limited, and the length of this limb varies significantly depending on the amount of weight loss that is desired. So there are numerous medical complications associated with Roux-en-Y. Not surprisingly, there are significant metabolic and nutritional derangements because of the restrictive nature of the surgery, as well as the malabsorption that is induced. Iron, calcium, vitamin B12, thiamine, and folate are commonly decreased in these patients and often require parenteral supplementation. These patients are also at risk for nephrolithiasis. And the type of stones that are that result from gastric bypass are typically calcium oxalate. Under normal physiologic conditions, calcium oxalate complexes with calcium within the gut, and that is then excreted in the stool. And there's very little oxalate absorption into the bloodstream. The malabsorption that's induced by gastric bypass leads to a significant amount of fat within the lumen, and calcium then preferentially couples to the fat, leaving oxalate free and able to be absorbed into the bloodstream. This ultimately gets filtered and deposited within the kidney and can cause significant scarring. Renal failure has also been associated with a hyperoxaluric state, although it's not a common complication. And in retrospective studies, the patients that went on to develop renal failure after bypass surgery typically were hypertensive and diabetic. Postoperative hypoglycemia is a common complication after bypass surgery, and most commonly it's due to dumping syndrome. But we do need to keep in mind that pancreatic nascitoblastosis, or beta islet cell hypertrophy, has been specifically associated with Roux-en-Y gastric bypass. And it's thought that it is related to the release of pancreatic trophic factors, such as glucagon-like peptide 1. Typically, patients are instructed to consume low-carbohydrate containing diets, and mostly they're able to be managed with dietary modifications. In those that are unable to comply with the diet or the diet's not effective, the use of acarbose, which is an alpha-galactosidase inhibitor, can be very effective in managing symptoms. And if patients are refractory to dietary modification and medical management, then a subtotal pancreatectomy could be indicated. So it's just important to keep that in mind. Not surprisingly, because this surgery does induce a malabsorptive state, diarrhea is a very, very common complication postoperatively. And it's important to counsel patients about this preoperatively. Not surprisingly, if patients don't decrease the amount of fat that they're ingesting, the fat malabsorption or steatorrhea is a very common complication. And lactose intolerance can also contribute to steatorrhea, especially in patients that are using dairy products to maintain their oral intake of protein postoperatively. They're also at extremely high risk for bacterial overgrowth, just because there's a long segment of small intestine that's out of circuit with the flow throughout the digestive tract. Dumping syndrome is a very common complication of bypass surgery, and it can occur in up to 50% of patients. The physiology is very different between the early and late dumping syndrome. Early dumping syndrome occurs within 15 minutes of oral intake, and the mechanism behind this is that there's a hyperosmolality of the material within the lumen causes a rapid shift of fluid from the plasma. This results in hypotension and then a sympathetic nervous system response. The good thing is that this is usually self-limited and resolves approximately 7 to 12 weeks postoperatively, and patients are instructed to decrease the simple sugars that they're consuming, eat more complex carbohydrates, fiber, protein, and to eat smaller, more frequent meals. In late dumping syndrome, the mechanism is completely different. It's an exaggerated insulin response in response to the hyperglycemia associated with oral intake. These patients typically present with dizziness, fatigue, diaphoresis, and weakness, the typical symptoms associated with hypoglycemia. And the patients are counseled for the same dietary modifications as with early dumping syndrome. So the focus of my conversation this morning are the mechanical complications associated with bypass surgery. There are many different mechanical problems that can arise in the post-bypass patient, and it can be very confusing unless you keep a clear picture of the anatomy in your mind, and then it's fairly straightforward in trying to piece together where in the GI tract the problem may arise. Gastric remnant distension can occur involving the remnant stomach and the rumen. Stomal stenosis or narrowing at the gastrojejunal anastomosis is also a common complication. The most common thing that I have run into are marginal ulcerations, which occur at the gastrojejunal anastomosis, and they can also occur at the jejunojejunal anastomosis. These patients are also at an increased risk of developing cholelithiasis and subsequently cholecystolithiasis, and that's a significant problem from a luminal gastroenterology standpoint because ERCP is virtually impossible in these patients, especially with the newer techniques with a longer rulem. And then fistulas can occur. You can have a fistulous tract between the remnant stomach and the pouch. This used to be a very common complication, especially in the early days of gastric bypass surgery, where they didn't actually separate the pouch from the remnant stomach. It was just stapled off. And a gastrogastric fistula could occur with a frequency of up to 50%. But now that this pouch is completely transected from the remnant stomach, this is on the order of 3%. And you also have to keep in mind that a fistulous communication can occur with the gastric pouch and the intestine or colon. So the first complication that I'd like to discuss is gastric remnant distension. And the etiology of this is varied. Patients can develop a paralytic ileus. A distal mechanical obstruction can occur due to a narrowing marginal ulceration at the jejunojejunal anastomosis, which limits the flow of bile, pancreatic enzymes, and gastric acid into the distal part of the small bowel. These patients are at risk for internal hernias of the small intestine, and there is also the risk of iatrogenic injury to the vagal fibers along the lesser curvature. What happens is that the remnant becomes progressively enlarged and dilated, and this can have absolutely catastrophic results with severe peritonitis due to the release of gastric acid, bile, and pancreatic enzymes into the peritoneal cavity. These patients are sick when they present, severe abdominal pain. They commonly have hiccups or shoulder pain due to the increased pressure along the inferior margin of the diaphragm, and they're often tachycardic with significant abdominal distension and shortness of breath. These patients look sick. On physical exam, left upper quadrant tympani is something that you should look for. It's commonly present. And on imaging, you can see a gastric air bubble. And the treatment for this is emergent decompression with a gastrostomy tube or a percutaneous drainage. And endoscopic therapy for this is not helpful. In order for us to access the remnant stomach, we have to move down through the pouch, down to the jejunum, make a turn through the jejunal-jejunal anastomosis, move retrograde through the duodenum, and enter the pylorus in a retrograde fashion, which can be done. It's extremely difficult, but in the longer rulem reconstructions, it's almost impossible. Not to mention we're adding air the entire time we're doing the endoscopy to see, and we will end up compounding problems. So it's surgery or interventional radiology for decompression. Stomal stenosis is narrowing at the gastrojejunal anastomosis due to chronic tissue ischemia. Naturally, there's decreased flow to an anastomosis due to scar tissue. There can be increased tension at the gastrojejunal anastomosis as well, which can compromise blood flow. And this typically presents several weeks postoperatively. Not surprising, patients have nausea, vomiting, and they can even have dysphagia because if there's very limited flow out of the pouch, swallowing can be compromised. And these patients typically lose a lot of weight. They may not report it early on because that's obviously the goal of gastric bypass, but any significant drop in weight after the weight's stabilized postoperatively needs to be investigated further. In order to diagnose stomal stenosis, we usually detect it on upper endoscopy because many of the symptoms that they present with are red flag signs that you would send for EGD. And upper GI series can also detect these narrowings. And the treatment is typically endoscopic balloon dilation. And it's a very successful approach with a perforation rate on the order of 3%. It's very rare for surgical revision to be required, but on rare occasion, less than 0.05% revision of the anastomosis is necessary. Marginal ulcers are the most common complication that I've encountered in the post-bypass patient, and the etiology is similar to stomal stenosis, and the poor tissue perfusion can result from tension or just a flow at the surgical anastomotic site. The foreign material used to suture or staple the anastomosis can lead to scarring and fibrosis, which can further compromise blood flow. And rarely, the gastrojejunal anastomosis can be affected by excess acid exposure. If you look at the anatomy, you can see that Roux-en-Y is an excellent anti-reflux surgery because the body of the parietal cell mass is excluded from the esophagus. So in order for a patient to develop reflux after bypass, you would have to have movement of the acid down the rulum, move retrograde, affect the pouch, and then go up into the esophagus. So a patient that develops new onset of heartburn after a Roux, you have to have a clinical suspicion that there's a gastrogastric fistula formation. The gastric acid is usually more of an issue at the jejunal anastomosis because of just the way that the gastric acid drains. Non-steroidal anti-inflammatories are a very common cause of marginal ulcers, and unfortunately we see this very commonly. Patients typically have a lot of arthritic problems just because of the weight and are used to taking NSAIDs, and we've seen a lot of significant upper GI bleeds due to NSAIDs in the post-bypass patient. H. pylori is also a very significant problem. There's a high prevalence of H. pylori infection in bariatric patients. And retrospective studies have shown that preoperative treatment of H. pylori in this population can decrease the rate of marginal ulcer formation from just under 7% to about 2.4%. And of course, smoking is still a risk factor for ulcer formation in these patients as well. These patients present with the typical symptoms that we would expect to see with peptic ulcer disease: nausea, abdominal pain, bleeding, melena, perforation. The treatment of marginal ulcers is very variable. Usually when patients come in with bleed, we immediately put them on a proton pump inhibitor. But the gastric acid suppression is really only effective if there's a gastrogastric fistula or if the ulceration occurs at the jejunal anastomosis. If it's just at the gastrojejunal anastomosis, there's no acid being exposed to the anastomosis, so PPI therapy is not helpful in standard gastrojejunal marginal ulcerations. And that's why we use sucralfate in these patients. So the sucralfate will bind, perform a protective layer to the ulcer, and then this will heal on its own. Obviously, as usual, we recommend a discontinuation of NSAIDs, smoking cessation. We treat the H. pylori if they have it. There's some evidence to show that calcium channel blockers can be effective in the treatment of marginal ulceration, but this is not something that we're using as standard of care at this time. Endoscopy or IR embolization is typically what we do to treat bleeding lesions, and surgery is reserved, obviously, for cases that don't respond to medical and endoscopic or interventional modalities. If surgery is required, there needs to be revision of the gastrojejunostomy, and truncal vagotomy is performed at that time as well. Ulcers within the excluded stomach are a real challenge. You know, we're used to being able to visualize the stomach easily with an endoscope, and clearly, in order to access the excluded stomach, it's quite a challenge endoscopically. And more often than not, if a remnant ulcer is suspected, then it's a surgical exploration with possible intraoperative endoscopy. So cholelithiasis is also a common problem in the post-bypass patient. Rapid weight loss increases the lithogenicity of bile, and up to 38% of post-bypass patients develop stones within the first 6 months, and 41% of those patients go on to become symptomatic. And there is some data to show that frequency of gallstone formation can be decreased with a six-month course of ursodiol. Cholecystectomy at the time of bypass is typically performed if a patient is symptomatic, but it's more controversial in patients that don't have symptoms of gallbladder disease at the time of surgery. And routine cholecystectomy is not necessarily being performed. And this it causes quite a bit of a problem from a GI standpoint as far as ERCP goes. When they were first doing the gastric bypasses, the Roux limbs were much, much shorter, and it was theoretically possible to get this duodenoscope to the ampulla. But with the longer reconstructions, it's virtually impossible to get to the biliary tree and perform therapeutic endoscopy. If a patient has a G-tube, then it's very easy. If the G-tube's been in place, we can remove the tube and then place the scope directly into the remnant stomach and access the biliary tree that way. But this is not something that's, we don't place G-tubes in order to perform ERCP. Internal hernias are an interesting subset of problems that can occur in these patients with a frequency of up to 5%. The most common defect is the defect in the transverse mesocolon at the jejunal anastomosis. But there are three potential areas of herniation. There's also a potential between the transverse mesocolon and the rulum, and in the transverse mesocolon if the rulum is past retrocolic. So often it's very important to get the operative note to know exactly how the reconstruction was performed. Internal hernias are very difficult to diagnose due to their intermittent nature, and they can be very difficult to detect radiographically. And if it's suspected based on the history, surgical consultation is indicated. An internal hernia can have absolutely devastating consequences, especially if in a longer rulum reconstruction. If a long segment of small bowel gets caught in the hernia and necroses, it can result in short bowel syndrome. There's a mesenteric swirl sign, which is the classic sign for an internal hernia, and you're fortunate if you're able to see that. Oftentimes, the imaging is not very helpful. It's more of a clinical concern that's raised. Persistent obesity is a common problem as well after surgery. There's a very small subset of patients that just fail to lose weight postoperatively, and it's typically due to maladaptive eating patterns during the early postoperative period. The more common scenario is that patients lose weight and then regain the weight, and that occurs in about 20% of patients. And the people that are at the highest risk are the super obese with a body mass index of over 50 at the time of their surgery. With weight regain, the progressive non-compliant eating usually leads to gradual enlargement of the gastric pouch, so the restrictive nature of the surgery is compromised, and this can lead to subsequent dilation of the gastrojejunal anastomoses. There has been a lot of research into modifying the anastomosis endoscopically, but they don't have any long-lasting results typically. And the formation of a gastrogastric fistula can also undermine the restrictive nature of the bypass surgery by allowing food to be absorbed, or the nutrients in the duodenum, which is typically excluded. So if a patient is gaining a significant amount of weight postoperatively, it's important to make sure that the dietary issues are addressed. And you need to think about a fistula. And the best way to diagnose a fistula is on an upper GI series with small bowel follow-through. And remember to ask about new symptoms of heartburn in somebody who's gaining weight. And if they're present, then you need to think about the gastrogastric fistula. And if it's present, then surgical revision is required. For the dilation of the gastric pouch or the gastrojejunal anastomosis, these patients don't benefit at all from a weight standpoint with revision of their anastomosis, and we really need to try and combat the underlying problem that's leading to the maladaptive eating behavior. Excessive weight loss can also be a problem after bypass surgery, but it's not something that's typically recognized very early just because patients have been thrilled that they have plateaued and then they lose another 20 or 30 pounds and don't think it's a problem until they get down to a critical weight. They're at extremely high risk for bacterial overgrowth just because a long segment of the small bowel is out of circuit with the flow from the gut. And patients can develop a gastrointestinal fistula. So you can have a fistulous communication between the remnant pouch in the small intestine or the pouch in the colon. And this is an endoscopic picture of a patient of mine that I took care of about a year and a half ago. And this is what a fistula looks like endoscopically. And this was in the gastric pouch. I followed it up with an upper GI series. And she had a long fistulous communication with a transverse colon. And when I had seen her in the office, she had lost 55 pounds in 6 months. And she had reported that as soon as she ate, so within 5 minutes she had to use the bathroom, and she could see whatever she had eaten completely undigested in the toilet. So you have to be thinking about excess extraintestinal fistulization. So in conclusion, the post-gastric bypass patient has a unique series of metabolic and mechanical complications that we need to be aware of. And understanding the post-surgical anatomy and physiology is essential in order to diagnose these conditions early on. And the standard therapy for common diseases such as cholelithiasis or even peptic ulcer disease are very different in the bypass patient due to their anatomy. And our standard workup and treatment is not necessarily applicable to these patients. That's it. Any questions? Dr. Sussman? About the hepatic failure and a post-bypass?
Have to start working at 9 o'clock. So the question was hepatic failure, and people who go into bypass surgery frequently have very advanced fatty liver disease, and fatty liver, and many of them have cirrhosis. So it won't be unusual for your surgeon to call you and say, "I have a cirrhotic. You know, I put in the laparoscope, and they're cirrhotic." Those people, fatty liver is caused by both weight gain and weight loss. And so there's very rapid weight loss. You have rapid mobilization of free fatty acids, which are taken up by the liver, and the liver then can't handle all of that load. And so it rapidly expands to fatty liver. We've had a few patients who've had to transplant a year to 18 months after their surgery, when they've just continued to lose weight. And so it's something to watch out. It's acute fatty liver. The treatment is to maintain their weight loss at a safe level, and they will usually get through it.
Thank you.
Do you ever use interventional radiology to treat the isolated part of the stomach with suspected or actual ulcers, bleeding ulcers?
Well, the problem is making the diagnosis of an ulcer in the remnant stomach. It's usually a clinical suspicion. And typically, patients that have severe pain in their abdomen may have a pancreatitis associated with it, just because of the close proximity of the remnant stomach to the pancreas. So in a patient who has severe abdominal pain and biochemical evidence of pancreatitis, then typically surgical exploration is something that's warranted, because the assumption is that it's an ulcer in the remnant, but you can't confirm that diagnosis. So usually it's surgical with possible intraoperative endoscopy.
Yeah, question for the primary care doctor seeing these people after their surgery. What do you recommend with vitamin B12? Do you think it's adequate to do oral versus injectable? What's your thought on that?
I recommend injectable, just because it's a problem with absorption. So they should get parenteral B12 injection. And a common thing as well is we'll commonly get patients referred to us for upper endoscopy for iron deficiency anemia. They may not have any symptoms whatsoever, but iron deficiency is an inherent side effect of the procedure, because the iron absorption occurs within the duodenum, and that's taken out of circuit, so the oral iron is just not absorbed. And so in severe cases, they do require parenteral iron administration as well. Anything else? All right. Thank you.